Session number 13265, reel number 5.
Mr. Marsden, reel 5.
An interesting thing occurred round about this time. Adrian Boyd had a new canopy delivered for his Hurricane. It was one which he'd managed to have specially made, and unlike the standard Hurricane, which has, I suppose you'd say, 9 panels in the framework, has framed panels in the structure of the sliding canopy, this was one-piece perspex which had integrally moulded blisters on either side. The blisters were about the size of the standard blister which you can see on Halifaxes and things of that order later, which were added as extras. And the blister was about 18 inches long and large enough so that you could tilt your head sideways into it and see forward and backwards and downwards, which you could otherwise not do with a closed canopy. And we gathered that it had been handmade, hand pulled or hand blown, I'm not sure which, at ICI, and that this one was the first successful product. They'd had to make 2 or 3 to get one good one. Well, at this date in
1940, that kind of perspex moulding was, of course, by no means common. In fact, it was a rarity. This was probably the very first canopy of this order, and Boyd's Hurricane was certainly the only Hurricane so fitted, and we all felt that this sort of made our flight commander just that bit special. He was a special chap in many ways anyway. And it was designed, of course, to give greatly improved visibility. It wasn't taken up by Air Ministry simply because production of it, production methods at that date were such that it wouldn't have been viable, sensibly viable. If one says economically viable, you have to think in wartime terms, in terms of man hours and materials. And it was obvious, though, that it would be the beginning of a process of development which led to the blown and moulded cockpit hoods which came in later on Spitfires and other aircraft. But I think Adrian Boyd should have the credit, or have some credit, for this development. On the Spitfire, a similar hood without blisters, I think, is known as a Malcolm hood later. I suppose some chap Malcolm was involved in it, or with it. That was one thing. Another item of small interest, it's of some amusing interest to flying people. The station commander had a beautiful Hawker Hart Hind, I'm not sure which, because they all the Hart Hind varieties look very much alike, but he had this beautiful silver biplane polished up to the knocker, and he would occasionally have it wheeled out and take a flight in it, and we all admired it because the Hart series are pretty aeroplanes. I remember he'd brought it down onto the end of the east-west runway, the 25 runway, and it was sitting at the western end ready for takeoff. And a Hurricane came into land and landed smack on top of it, and no one was injured, which was the remarkable thing. You know, both aircraft had it. I mean, the one that's flying coming into land obviously got its engine running. The Hart Hind, whatever it was ticking over, ready to take off. that was running nicely. The pilot sitting in the cockpit, and there we have. It was just like a ginormous mating, of the, you know, with the Hurricane on top of the heart, as though it was trying to breed a new development. Of course, all rotten types like the ground crew, he just stood and fell about laughing, of course, and didn't go anywhere near it in case we got involved in the work of clearing it up. It wasn't one of our Hurricanes, so I suppose it must have been 43 or 601. That wasn't my concern. One quickly learned in the services that where you're not concerned, you keep your nose out. It's a lot easier. Anyway, I was saying, I mentioned night flying, I think, earlier, and I was diverted. Boyd was a duty pilot for night flying. There was usually just one pilot on duty per night. Worked in rotation around the squadrons. Adrian Boyd was on as duty pilot, and he didn't have to sit at readiness in the aircraft, nor did we, because we were so rarely called out. So he'd gone in, he was in the crew room in his pyjamas, and there was a squawk and on the telephone, and he was called out to intercept a German raider, and he galloped out in his pyjamas and flying jacket and flying boots, and Jenkinson and I we got kite started and got him in and got him away, and then we all sat around. We had at this time in the pilot's crew room a radio receiver which could be tuned in to the aircraft, so we could hear what Boyd was doing in the air. And we sat around to see what would happen. And then we saw, coming across the airfield from the direction of the Downs, from on Tangier, from the direction of the windmill, which would be a northeast-southwest line, we could see the exhaust flares of a twin-engined aircraft. And we could see the stars being blotted out by the loom of the kite as it flew across them. And then we saw behind it the exhaust flare of a single-engined aircraft, and we soon realised that this was Boyd. These both aircraft were quite low, 1,000 feet or so, I guess. No great altitude at all. And as it came close, I could see the vague dark silhouette and realised it was a Heinkel 111. And from the odd word that came through on the radio, we realised that Boyd was coming up behind him. We were waiting for him to shoot this kite down and drop it smack on the end of the airfield. It looked as though that was exactly what he was going to do. Everything was going beautifully for an interception. And it would have been the first night fighter kill of the war. And then guess what? The army stepped in, shot the searchlights on, smack onto Boyd, and blinded him. And the Heinkel went whoom, nose down, and streaked away towards the coast, hell for leather. And the language that came down over that radio from Boyd's aircraft, we wouldn't believe it. He did his luck. Largely because he'd lost the chance, you see, of going into the history books as the first night kill. And he wasn't happy when he landed at all. Not at all happy. Well, that's... where do we go from there? Well, then things began to warm up a little bit more, and we began to get some more activity, and the aircraft were operating sufficiently that there was a request by the station armoury for volunteers to help out in the armoury, loading belts and loading Vickers K pans. The K is the Vickers GO. You see, it described as the GO gas operated, or as the K alt. It's the same gun. that replaced the Lewis, you know, on the rear guns and manually operated guns. Very high rate of fire. And so I and a couple of others from our squadron, we went across and offered ourselves and got involved in our spare time in loading belts. And that's where we came across De Wilde ammunition. Have you heard of De Wilde?
Somebody's mentioned it to me, but I've forgotten what it is.
De Wilde is it was a 303 ammunition, and it was recognisable because the bullets were a kind of dull gold in appearance, and we were told it was a semi armour piercing incendiary. At least that's the story I got. If you look up in the literature, you find out that I think it was a Belgian invention, and in 39, I think, or 38 or 39, it was turned down by the RAF. I'm not sure whether it was turned down for technical reasons or simply because it was incendiary. You may remember that in the First World War, incendiary ammunition at one time was supposed to be banned, regarded as inhuman or one thing or another, just as though it's human to get 303 rounds into you at any time. Anyway, it was. I'm not sure. I don't know whether the Germans took it up, whether it was offered to the Germans, they took it up, but certainly he offered it. It came back again and it got into service. Some pilots said they didn't like to use it because they thought it damaged the barrels of the guns, the gun barrels. But Boyd, he said he was happy to use all of it that was put there. He didn't mind because he didn't mind whether the enemy boiled or fried, particularly, as long as they were down. We had a Polish pilot, Pankratz. He was flight lieutenant. He was quite happy to use it. His attitude towards the Germans, when you asked him how many he'd shot down, because he'd been operational in Poland when the thing started, his attitude was that he didn't care how many he'd shot down, he was only interested in how many were left. You'll find that, I think, quoted elsewhere. We used to just shovel the stuff in anyway. Belt ammunition for Brownings, I don't know if you know about it. It was disintegrating belts, you know, with the small links which come out and are shot out of the aircraft with the empty cartridge case as the guns fire. And the method of making the belt up was automatic. You put the rounds into a hopper in a small machine, all the rounds facing the same way. There was another hopper which carried the links, which were loaded in, if I recall, they were loaded in from boxes, so they all fed the same way. You simply turned a handle, and lo and behold, out of the end came a machine gun belt, all properly made up. The only thing was that we used to gauge all the ammunition, gauge it for size, diameter, before loading it in, to make sure that it was all within size, so that the jams wouldn't occur. And for Hurricanes, the belts were loaded into ammunition tanks, 350 rounds per gun, and there were 8 tanks in the aircraft, but the tanks were paired, so that there were two tanks at the left-hand side of a gun bay, with the tanks staggered so that the belts could feed the gun, staggered fore and aft, and on the right-hand side of the gun bay were two other tanks, with the tanks staggered to feed the guns from that side. So the two left-hand guns were fed from left to right, and the two right-hand guns were fed from right to left. And there was a gun bay in each wing in the Hurricane. This was one of the huge advantages which the Hurricane had over the Spitfire. We could rearm a Hurricane in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes. Spitfire required 26 minutes to rearm. And this meant that, in fact, if things really got hot and aircraft were coming down and going up, one Hurricane was worth two Spitfires, as you can see. As I say, we took part in as volunteers in that. We quite often spent time over on the flights when we could have been elsewhere, simply just to be available, to be useful if necessary. I think now I ought to mention one or two things about flight operations at this time in the service. I should have mentioned one item in connection with the Hampton and 83 Squadron at the same time. Aircraft in the Air Force were mostly started with electric starters. Quite a large hand-hauled trolley on the ground, a two-wheel trolley, fitted with 24 volts supply from accumulators, from wet batteries, driving an electric starter fitted onto the engine. There were a few aircraft at this time and more later which were fitted with Kaufman starters. That's the cartridge starter. When you see film of an aircraft starting up, you get a puff of smoke coming out from behind the engine, jetting out. That's from a Kaufman starter, COFFMAN, which was a kind of large, it looked like a large shotgun cartridge, about an inch and a half, if I recall, yes, about an inch and a half in diameter, about 4 inches long, and that generated a gas charge which was fed into a piston which ran in a spirally splined cylinder. So when the gas charge hit the piston travelled forwards and spun, and that spin was imparted to the aircraft engine to kick it over to start it. But the electric starter, you simply coupled a cable in from the trolley on the ground, and the pilot then pressed the starter button in the aircraft, and the mechanic on the ground pressed the matching button on the trolley, and the electric power then turned the engine, and you could turn the engine for as long as the battery lasted. Except, of course, if you did that without starting it properly, you'd flood the engine and make a proper hack of things. But anyway, that was part of the system. Well, at the beginning of the war, we had one starter trolley per 10 Hamptons. So we had two starter trolleys per squadron. So if you wanted to start all the aircraft up in the squadron, you had to start them up by hand. Well, I should have told this story earlier. To start a Hampton by hand, you had a large starting handle which was normally carried in the aircraft, stowed. It was about the size of a truck starting handle. I don't know if you see truck starting handles these days at all, but if you think of a shaft going into the engine coupling for the starter coupling, about 18 inches long, with a crank on it, 12 to 15 inches, and then a handle on that, another 12, 15 inches, so that you can get two hands on it. In the Hampton, that was pushed up into a socket in the side of the engine nacelle at about, shall I say, 4 or 5 o'clock, if you think of the engine nacelle as a circle with a clock face on it, or at about 45 degrees, whichever, and so that it was tending to drop out all the time. And so to turn it and turn a 1,000 horsepower engine, quite a big engine, you had to both push it in and turn. Now, there's a reduction gear so that you turn the engine quite slowly, and you're dependent upon the pilot in the cockpit using the throttle very carefully, because on aircraft engines, on aircraft piston engines, connected to the throttle in the carburettor is an accelerator pump, just as there is in a modern car engine. When you press the pedal, the accelerator pedal in a modern car engine to accelerate, you press a tiny, you also push down a tiny pump which gives a squirt of neat fuel into the manifold, so that the inertia, the lag in the flow of fuel, which is caused by the inertia in the fuel itself, which results when you open the throttle within the manifold, there would normally be a lag which would cause a flat spot. And so that when you went to accelerate, the engine would and cough instead of whoomph. And the accelerator pump takes care of that. It provides that little extra squirt of fuel to cover that up, which is why if you use the accelerator pedal coarsely, too much, your fuel consumption goes up enormously. And that's why also you can adjust, or used to be able to adjust, from summer to winter settings on the carburetor throttle settings. Anyway, aircraft engines were normally started in those days with the use of a KyGas pump. Now, in the Hurricane, the KyGas pump is in the cockpit, available to the pilot. On twin-engined aircraft, the KyGas pump, for plumbing reasons and sensible reasons, was commonly in the nacelle, under the engine, in the engine nacelle, adjacent to the engine. And it's a single-cylinder pump. You have, with the handle or cap, it's screwed firmly into place so that when not in use, you get no bleed of fuel. In other words, the fuel bleed, the engine could run sufficiently rich so that the fuel consumption would go up enormously. And instead of having, say, 2 hours endurance, you'd have three quarters and end up going down out of fuel somewhere where you didn't want to be. So, to start the engine, you unscrew the KyGas pump and give the engine the number of strokes of the pump which, from experience, you know is required. We're talking, say, the Hampton. So, if it's a cold engine, we might give it 8 strokes. If it's a hot engine, we might give it none or one, whatever. Well, on this particular occasion, Gibson came out to the aircraft and wanted it started up so that he could taxi it back over to the hangars for some reason best known to himself. It was a cold, foggy, misty September-October morning in Lincolnshire, really wet, and in those conditions, starting a Hampton up by hand is not that easy anyway. Anyway, I primed the engine, and Gibson was in the cockpit, and I started turning the handle, and the engine coughed, and I knew that Gibson was pumping the throttle because there was fuel dripping from the air intake. Air intakes, in fact, those air intake scoops you see under the engine nacelles or under the nose of a Hurricane and so on, they actually have a small hole drilled through the air intake vertically so that any excess fuel can drain out. Because if you get a cough back, it's possible to get a fire start in the air intake, and the aircraft will, if you don't stop it, you could simply burn the aircraft out. That was known to happen. In fact, there were techniques for stopping it. The usual one was to take the field service cap, ram it over the air intake and keep the engine turning, which accounted for the fact that so many flight mechanics' caps looked a bit scorched and burned. So I could see he was pumping the throttles and it was flooding, and the engine simply wouldn't start. And I wound, and then the handle slipped out, clouted me across the scalp and cut my head and so on. And then Gibson started bawling down at me in various abusive terms, "Put your back into it, man," and swearing and so on. Which of course we know he shouldn't have done, but he was a flight lieutenant and I was a lowly erk. And eventually I managed to get him to open the throttle wide, and I wound the engine till it was clear, and then we started again and we got it going, and away he went. Well, I think it was from that point on that I really didn't like Gibson. And there was nothing I heard about him after that either, ever since, has made me improve my opinion of him. He was a genuine archetypal hero in the Greek mould, kind of gets people killed. I don't know. I'm not the first to say it. I might be the first to say it on tape. But if you check around enough people who really knew him, you'll find that there's a diversity of opinion about Gibson.
Did you have any other friction with him?
No. But I've served under other people. I served under other people of, if you like, in terms of the literature, in terms of history, of equal calibre, and very different from Gibson. Anyway, you'll see that when we come up to it.
Yes.
We get back, I'm not quite sure where we got to on the hurricanes now, after that diversion.
You were telling me about the different methods of starting the aircraft.
Oh, that's right, yes. Well, on the Hurricane, you could start a Hurricane by hand with a hand-turning gear. The difference being that two handles were provided, and you could have a handle on either side of the aircraft and start it by hand. But it was a bit dicey because you were standing with your back to the air screw and with your back within maybe a yard of it, maybe less. By the time you've got your hands on a handle to turn it, on a hand turning gear at the back of a Merlin engine, and then you've got to assume that your handle, that the starting handle in your arms makes about 3 feet odd, and there's only about 6 feet on the length of the engine, so that it's a job which requires a modicum of care, otherwise you might step back into the propeller, which would cause an awful lot of fuss, a lot of paper to be filled out and whatnot afterwards for the survivors. Anyway, we have the starter trolley, and by this stage of the game we have a starter trolley for each aircraft. It's essential on a fighter squadron. We hadn't starter trolleys for each aircraft when we got to Tangier, but they came along. But in terms of maintenance, there were other areas where there was enormous deficiencies. The early Hurricane, up to about, I would guess, July, late August 1940, had an air compressor known as the BTH type. It was... the air compressor was necessary for the wheel brakes, and I'm not sure, but I think also for operating the guns. When the guns were fired, you press the button, and it was done by air pressure to release the cocked guns. And I have an idea it was maybe 200 pounds pressure, operating pressure, in the compressed air system on the aircraft. And the BTH air compressor